Hello, I'm Sue, one of today's readers. Welcome to the primary edition of your local talking newspaper, covering St Albans, Harpenden and all the villages within the district. The piece of music you have just heard is called Cuckoo. As always, our thanks go to Goffby Music, who has allowed us to use this piece of music. Today's edition of your talking newspaper is for the week ending the 4th of August 2018. The news items come from the Hearts Advertiser and the Review. Here is my first news item. New junction mooted for the M1. Hearts County Council, HCC, is currently consulting on its new South West Hearts Growth and Transport Plan, which outlines travel infrastructure proposals for the future. The plan suggests the creation of a new M1 junction 8A to the north of Hemel Hempstead, between junctions 8 and 9, might alleviate likely traffic jams if major housing developments are built in that area as part of the St Albans local plan. If nothing changes, there will be 2,400 new homes at East Hemel Hempstead South, 1,650 homes at East Hemel Hempstead North, and 1,500 houses at North Hemel Hempstead, built by 2036. It is hoped the new junction would free up routes along the A414 between Junction 8 and Green Lane. However, this major undertaking would cost up to £50 million to implement. This scheme is part of a long-term plan which would come to fruition after 2031, and until that time, improvements to the current Junction 8 have been deemed sufficient to deal with traffic strain. The chair of neighbouring Redbourne Parish Council, David Mitchell, said although he does not support more than 5,000 new homes in the ward, if they must be built, then a motorway junction may be a good way to tackle the influx of new traffic. He said, "Of course, you have to address the issues of all the extra traffic with the development, but I know it won't go down well with the residents to know there's a motorway junction by Redbourne. There's no doubt that something has to be done, and that's the problem. What will it mean for pollution, both atmospheric and noise? I genuinely don't know if the junction would be the best option or the worst option for Redbourne." St Albans District Council, SADC, do not support the proposal, instead backing a new link road from Junction 8 to Green Lane and Boundary Way. David warned this might create a giant roundabout around the village. He added, "I think the idea of Junction 8A will horrify most residents, and I think there's going to be a big campaign to try and stop it. But I think it's important to get the message out about the consultation so people can respond. You can't just say no, 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 you can't do that, because it's not about whether we want the development, it's about whether we want the road if the development goes ahead. So we have to keep an open mind." Councillor Mary Maynard, portfolio holder for planning at SADC, said the council has responded to the HCC consultation. "This is a flexible, evolving document that will be continually updated in the years ahead. Currently, it suggests there may be a need for in the future for a new M1 junction near Redbourne known as 8A. That would be partly to serve new residential areas proposed in our local plan for an area east of Hemel Hempstead. We have not supported this idea as our draft local plan has an alternative proposal for a new link road from M1 Junction 8 to the Green Lane Boundary Way roundabout. We understand that the idea has been supported in principle by Highways England. However, we are continually working with our partners to ascertain future infrastructure needs. HCC analysis suggests that the vast majority of trips into Hemel Hempstead come partly from St Albans and Luton, in private cars using the A414. Cabinet Member for Growth, Infrastructure, Planning and the Economy at HCC, Councillor Derek Ashley, said, "We're expecting significant development at the Maylands Business Park and to the east of Hemel Hempstead in the coming decades, and we don't think the existing Junction 8 will be able to cope with the additional traffic. That's why we're looking into both how the existing junction can be improved and suggesting a new Junction A to the north of Hemel Hempstead. We've put this idea forward in our South West Harts Growth and Transport Plan, which sets out all the transport improvements we think the area needs to cope with and the expected growth in housing, jobs and traffic.
Hi, this is Liz. My first reading is from the Harts Ad comment section of the paper, and it's entitled, Where Are the Positives of Plan? This is how it begins. As the full implications of the forthcoming St Albans local plan come into focus, so too are the massive infrastructure developments which it will necessitate. New schools, additional health provision and a revised road network are key to supporting the future growth of the district, hence why we are now looking at the possibility of another junction from the M1. Although this scheme is being mooted by the County Council and not SADC, it is obviously being seen as vital to accompany the huge quantity of new homes envisioned for this part of the county. But for villagers in Redbourne, who are already facing the prospect of their corner of the world being irrevocably transformed by the local plan, the question of whether Junction 8A is a good thing or a bad thing is hard to answer. On the one hand, it might be deemed necessary to cope with the extra traffic from all of the additional housing, but does the village really want to end up as pretty much a service stop for the M1? Meanwhile, efforts by campaigners to call on the District Council to support a new A&E hospital in the local plan appear to be falling on deaf ears. Neither SADC or Harts Valley Clinical Commissioning Group appear to think the vast numbers of extra residents will require anything other than a redeveloped Watford General, and are arguably missing a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to provide West Harts with the health facilities it requires. It seems as though there are very few sweeteners to accompany the sour taste which will result from the upheaval of the local plan. So on the one hand, residents are facing the prospect of their communities being transformed forever by thousands of new homes, plus the prospect of being directly linked to one of the busiest motorways in the country. But then there are few rewards in terms of improved healthcare, investment in local infrastructure, or any other positive provisions.
It's hello from Mel, sending all our listeners a warm welcome. As temperatures soar again, our farmers are feeling the heat. There may have been a momentary respite thanks to the weekend's rainfall, but as temperatures begin climbing again, the hot weather is continuing to take its toll across the district. The extended period of dry weather and extreme temperatures have caused a number of issues for owners of farms and natural areas. Our biggest problem is the risk of fire, said Henry Holland Hibbert, owner of Bricketwood Common and Munden Farm. Munden Farm has had two fires, one due to a discarded cigarette and one deliberately set by some young lads, probably having a barbecue. All it takes is a discarded cigarette and just a bit of wind, and you'd be amazed how fast a fire can start. After long stretches without rainfall, including periods of up to 16 days, Henry remains optimistic about his agricultural interests. The crops are okay, but we could do with a lot more rain. We'll still get a farm full of wheat and corn, but it won't be as good as other years. But that's farming. You get the ups and the downs. Everyone's welcome to visit the common, he added, but please be careful. If we lose crops due to fire, then that's it. That's our business. The risk of fire seems to be a consistent worry for other farmers, such as Will Dickinson, owner of Cross Farm in Harpenden. He explained, there's an awful lot of very dry crops around, tinder dry. I'm absolutely conscious of the fact that we need everyone to be very, very careful, smokers particularly. But Will has more problems, with grass drying up, leaving livestock with nothing to eat. The sheep are running out of food. We're using our winter supply already. It's most scary. Emma Roberts from Hammond's End Farm, also in Harpenden, said they were experiencing similar troubles with farming in the heat. The harvest is in full swing, much earlier than usual. It's usually the 1st of August before we properly get our crops cut, but we're well ahead of that time. Our chicken flocks have lots of natural shade in their paddock, so are coping well, but we're having to refill their water 4 times a day instead of the usual 2. There's also very little grass growth for our small cattle herd, so we're needing to take them extra food out. All in all, we're coping, but there are extra jobs and challenges. She also reiterated the fire warning. We are very, very nervous about the potential fire risk while harvesting, as we are aware nationally more combines have caught fire this year with everything being so hot and dry. The extended period of heat has promptly added to the worries of older farmers who flash back to the summer of 1976, when Hertfordshire saw 15 days of heat in excess of 25 degrees, 10 of which peaked at 30 degrees. At that time, the country suffered a severe drought, prompting the government to pass the Drought Act of 1976, whilst crops failed and forest fires broke out in most parts of southern England. It's getting comparable, says Tony Scott, a data analyst for the Rothamsted Research Met Office, but some of the areas in 1996 had 15 days in excess of 30 degrees. In the current run of scorching weather, Harts experienced over 45 days when temperatures were above 23 degrees, but only a few in excess of 30 degrees. Although this Friday and Saturday are expected to reach their peak, Harts County Council Executive Member for Public Health and Prevention, Councillor Richard Roberts, has issued advice to residents during the heatwave. While many people enjoy hot weather, high temperatures can be dangerous, especially for people who may be particularly vulnerable, such as older people, young children, and those with serious illnesses. His advice is to take extra care during the heatwave.
Hello, this is Jane. My first article, Campaign Calls on Council to Back New A&E Hospital. A campaign to build a new hospital central to St Albans, Watford and Decorum has urged the council to consider potential sites as part of their local plan. Andy Love, who created a petition for a new hospital which reached more than 10,000 signatures, wrote to Tracy Harvey, St Albans Council's Head of Planning and Building Control, asking her to consider allocating land for development. Along with members of the New Hospital Campaign, NHC, Andy believes that a new acute A&E hospital in a central location would be more accessible and ultimately less time-consuming than redeveloping the existing Watford General Hospital, which would take 12 years. The government responded to the petition by saying that it was a matter for the local NHS Trust, which Andy felt was passing the buck. In his letter to the council, Andy asked whether the council had considered a site large enough for the new hospital in the local plan, given the amount of new housing planned for the district over the next 15 years. He wrote, "In my opinion, it would be unthinkable for the council to have given little or no consideration to releasing land for a new hospital development, given the state and location of West Hart's only A&E hospital in West Watford. Watford General Hospital has no direct bus service from St Albans, and taxi fares cost approximately £45 for a round trip. WHHT, that's West Hertfordshire Hospitals Trust, have plans to redevelop Watford General over at least 12 years, depending on funding. Andy proposed the former Radlett Airfield site as a potential location for the hospital, which is owned by Harts County Council, as well as land to the east of Hemel Hempstead, owned by Crown Estates, and the Golden Triangle in Brickett Wood, which is greenbelt land between Junction 6 of the M1 and Junction 21A of the M25. He also argued that a new centralised hospital would be the only way to meet increasing patient demand, with the council's need to build new homes leading to rapid population growth over the next 20 years. He said, "Decorum and Watford are equally under pressure to meet housing targets set by the government, so a new centralised hospital is probably the only solution. Watford Borough Council is backing the call for a new A&E hospital, but have proposed that it be built on the current Vicarage Road site. That would be costly and logistically hard to achieve without severe disruption." Councillor Mary Maynard, the council's portfolio holder for planning, said, "During the consultation for our draft local plan that identifies land for future development, we contacted 10 NHS organisations to see if they wanted to make a response. These included strategic bodies such as Harts Valleys Clinical Commissioning Group, HVCCG, and NHS England, whose role and expertise includes planning for future healthcare needs. We did not receive any submissions such as, for example, a request to earmark land for a new hospital. However, we will continue to engage with the NHS as the local plan progresses, so they are aware of likely population trends and can assess the health infrastructure impacts. An HVCCG spokesperson said, "We have not made any submissions for land for a new hospital as part of the local plan consultation because our locally agreed proposal for future hospital provision is based on developing existing sites. Having thoroughly investigated a number of options and carried out significant engagement with the local community, we reached the conclusion that a proposal to redevelop at the Watford and St Albans Hospital sites would be the most likely to succeed due to affordability and ease of delivery. This proposal was submitted to national NHS regulators, NHS Improvement and NHS England in September 2017. The CCG and West Harts Hospital Trust have been in discussion with them about how best to progress our plans, particularly given urgently needed investment into Watford General Hospital, and we await a definitive response regarding the next steps so that we can press forward with implementation. We fully appreciate the need to tie into local plans as well as taking into account planning and infrastructure considerations."
Is global warming to blame for the long hot summer? With grass and crops drying up and a lack of rainfall, we asked researchers at Rothamsted Research in Harpenden what they thought. Is the heatwave a sign of things to come, or is it just a bit of hot air? "You have to understand that there is weather and there is climate," said mathematical modeller Mikhail Semenov. "We know that climate is changing every year and the global climate is increasing. But we look at hot weather here, and we can't say that this is definitely occurring because of climate change. Patterns of hot weather aren't necessarily strange occurrences," he explained. "No one in 1976 was talking about climate change. In 2003, there was also a three-day period of temperatures above 33 degrees, with a peak of 35.6 degrees, but not a sustained period of hot weather as we are seeing now." However, Mikhail revealed, "When we look into the future, events like this one will be more frequent and more severe. Our model demonstrates that events like our heatwave will increase in frequency and magnitude with higher temperatures. But this one we cannot attribute directly to climate change, as weather is a very complicated system." Amanda Yearworth from the St Albans branch of Friends of the Earth echoed Mikhail's conclusions. "With climate scientists predicting that climate change will increase the severity and frequency of heat waves like this one, this heat wave is a call to action on climate change. We need to ensure that we are ready for increasingly regular extreme weather. Steps like planting more trees, both in the countryside for flood protection and in the streets to give cooling shade. Finally, the heat wave has focused our minds on the importance of water. Our area is predicted to be increasingly drought prone, yet our water use is well above the national average. We need to start treating it as the precious resource it is."
Luton Airport chief indicates support for new incinerator. The Harpenden Luton incinerator appears to have won the support of the chief operating officer for Luton Airport's landowner, days after Luton Borough Council's leader insisted the proposal had nothing to do with the airport. Energy company Emsrain is proposing to Central Bedfordshire Council to build the Lee Bank Energy Park at New Mill End, north of Harpenden and west of Kimpton, on greenbelt land close to the Luton Hoo estate. In a letter addressed to Emsrain, London Luton Airport Limited's Chief Operating Officer, Robin Porter, said the proposal presents an excellent opportunity to provide a secure, long-term renewable, low-carbon heat and power supply to London Luton Airport. He continues, "It will make a significant contribution towards national and local targets for carbon reduction and renewable energy generation, and therefore should be given substantial weight in terms of an assessment of its impact on the Greenbelt and designated heritage assets." His letter also includes details on a 5-kilometre pipeline from the incinerator to the airport to deliver hot water. This, as well as an underground cable to transport electricity, would power future developments on the airport site, including a mass transit system. This comes after the leader of Luton Borough Council, Hazel Simmons, told the Harts Ad Emsrain's application is not connected to or developed on behalf of London Luton Airport. This is a private developer who has submitted a proposal to Central Bedfordshire Council. The council's executive is yet to meet to agree the council's formal position on the proposals. However, we can confirm a combined heat and power plant are at odds with the council's own energy strategy and vision, which is based on solar and wind generation. I am also concerned by the potential impacts this plant would have on Luton, and we will be responding formally when Central Bedfordshire Council carry out a consultation as part of any statutory planning process. While our airport company has confirmed if the scheme was to be approved, there is potential for the airport to be among those who could benefit from this additional source of power, the board are also yet to meet to take a formal position. However, as the sole shareholder, we will be expressing our concerns to them about the proposal, particularly the potential environmental impacts for Luton. I hope this clears up Luton Council's current position on the matter, but clearly this is a matter for Central Bedfordshire Council. The campaign group United Kingdom Without Incineration Network launched a report last week saying incinerators produce particulate matter which can affect people's respiratory and cardiovascular systems. Tim Armstrong-Taylor of the Stop the Harpenden Luton Incinerator Group said, "We want clarity on it, that is the most important thing, and instead we are getting mixed signals. We want to know if this is part of the airport's expansion plans and if the airport has an agreement to get heat and power. There are conflicting opinions on this. We believe Luton Airport are in favour of this development and will be seeking some agreement, but the leader of Luton Borough Council is saying that is not the case." Chair of London Luton Airport Limited, Andy Malcolm, said, "I would like to be clear this proposed development is not connected to or on behalf of London Luton Airport Limited, LLAL. A technical letter of support was sent by our officers, who were approached by the developers in relation to the potential for this proposal to power the airport and surrounding developments, making clear this was absolutely conditional on impacts on the environment and the community being kept to a minimum. The LLAL board has since been able to meet to discuss the proposal in more detail and consider the views of both the general public and our shareholder, Luton Council, who have concerns about its potential impact. Any decision of the company with regard to meeting the airport's future energy needs will be mindful of our shareholders' emerging energy policy. However, planning decision is clearly a matter for Central Bedfordshire Council, which would need carefully to consider the environmental impact."
And here's the second article about incineration. Incineration boom as county sees 12% increase in waste being sent to burn. Harts County Council is sending more and more waste to be burnt by incinerators. In the year 2016-17, 36.7% of the total amount of waste the county produced was being sent to be burnt to produce energy, according to the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. This is the same process known as Energy for Waste, or EFW, which will be used at a massive incinerator plant being proposed on the site north of Harpenden. The National Coordinator for UKIN, which is the United Kingdom Without Incineration Network, said, "Unfortunately, councils are reacting too slowly to the growing public demand for more recycling and less incineration. Across the UK, there's more than 90 million tonnes of residual waste treatment capacity operational or under construction, but forecasts indicate that by 2030 there'll only be around 10 million tonnes of residual waste available for treatment. This means that we are already facing an overcapacity of incineration that is harming recycling. The real choice is not between incineration and landfill, but between incineration and recycling. The 36.7% this year continues an upward trend for incineration in the county. In 2014-15, 24% of our waste went to incineration, and in 2015-16, it went up to 31%. The council has been steadily reducing the amount which has gone to landfill, going from 140,000 tonnes in 2014-15 to 58,000 in 2016-17. A Harts County Council spokesman said, "Council uses a number of facilities for the disposal of residual waste. This includes energy recovery facilities, ERFs, and landfill sites. We are continuing to reduce the proportion of residual waste which is sent to landfill, where possible, and sending it to ERFs, creating electricity and pushing waste up the waste hierarchy. All ERFs have to be operated to meet stringent air quality and emission regulations to safeguard human health, and the environmental features are closely monitored and regulated by the environmental."
Thameslink train services in top 10 most overcrowded for England and Wales. Two train services through St Albans, Harpenden and Radlett are in the top 10 most overcrowded in England and Wales. The list by the Department of Transport, DFT, features the 1626 Bedford to Brighton service at 7th place in spring 2017, while the 0657 Brighton to Bedford was 9th in autumn of that year. The leader of Harpenden Thames Link commuters, Emily Ketchin, said the issue of overcrowding is a chronic one and has been made significantly worse at Harpenden after May 20, as we have lost a third of our services, 6:30 to 8:30, the time most people need to travel. We had 23 trains in that period and now we only have 15. The picture at Harpenden is even more bleak when you look at the statistics for our fast and semi-fast services, where we have lost 42% of trains, from 19 down to 11. In the meantime, the Thames Link Express trains whiz past Harpenden, half-loaded. I call again upon Thames Link to place immediate stop orders on those trains to stop them at Harpenden, and upon Chris Grayling to issue an instruction to make that stop order permanent. The Harpenden train problem has to be solved. According to the DfT, the capacity for the Thames Link train's standard passenger class is 401, but the train was loaded with 708 passengers, 307 passengers over capacity, in spring 2017. This increased to 477 passengers over capacity on the 657 service in autumn. A spokesperson for Govia Thames Link Railway, which runs services between Bedford and Brighton, said, "Passengers rightly expect to be able to travel to work in comfort, and we are sorry this was not always the case on the services highlighted on this survey. Our trains operate on the busiest part of the country's rail network, and to meet demand and plan for the future, we have since introduced more and longer trains carrying more passengers on the busiest sections many of these trains run through. These DfT figures only account for sitting room, not standing room, and Govia say once the Thames Link programme is completed, there will be 40% more carriages on the 1626 service, and they are building up to a 24% increase in the carriages on the 627 service."
Not fair. Taxi driver refuses to take disabled passengers. The incident occurred last Thursday when former president of the district's Chamber of Commerce, David Clark, who is blind, and Harpenden town councillor, Michael Weaver, who uses a wheelchair, were dining with the chamber's executive director, Lisa Bates-Wallace. Lisa called and paid ahead for a taxi to take them home, and they stood on the pavement to wait. But when the Gold Line taxi pulled up at 10:15 p.m, the driver was not parallel with the wheelchair. He was asked to move forward to make him more accessible, but he told Lisa, "I'm not dealing with this," and drove off. Another taxi was sent to pick them up, and Gold Line Taxis has since offered Lisa a refund and said she should report the driver to the council. "They feel that's the only way something will be done about it," she said. Apparently, the reason the driver didn't pick us up was that he had a bad back, but he never told me or anyone at Gold Line Taxis. Under the Equality Act, licensed taxi drivers using wheelchair-accessible vehicles cannot discriminate against wheelchair users and should give them assistance when required. Drivers can be made exempt if they provide evidence they are medically unable to assist passengers in wheelchairs, but this exemption should be displayed on the vehicle. Lisa said, "Gold Line told me the council will take it further, so I do feel they have been quite diligent and the driver is realising he's made a mistake." Part owner of Gold Line Taxis, Anil Ahmed, said, "We have contacted the customer and apologised. I do not know the full details, but this is not acceptable. Fair enough he has a problem with his ramp, but he should have taken time to explain." Sections of the Equality Act were activated last year after St Albans MP Anne Main highlighted the case of 65-year-old wheelchair user Jenny Page, who a Gold Line driver refused to take after he found out he would not get any help with unloading her at the other end. Fellow wheelchair user Dominique Hyams has also spoken at St Albans Council about his experiences of being refused service by taxi drivers and being made to wait for a lift.
Summer misery for motorists as work begins to install clever traffic lights. Drivers face a month of commuting chaos as roadworks bring London Coney to a standstill. HCC, Herts County Council, has started work to replace aging and faulty traffic lights at the roundabout where the A414 meets A1081. The new intelligent signals will detect how heavy congestion is in each direction and automatically modify its timings accordingly. However, there have already been long tailbacks, congestion, and reports of dangerous manoeuvres being performed in an attempt to outwit the lane closures around the roadworks. There will be resurfacing after the lights are installed, and works are scheduled to continue until August the 31st. A driver caught up in a jam at the junction, but who would like to remain anonymous, said, "I was driving to the A414 from London Road early on Saturday afternoon and was shocked to see such a long queue. I originally assumed it was due to some sort of crash on the M25, but it was actually these roadworks on the roundabout with not a worker in sight. Workmen are on site from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m, but lane closures are in place 24/7. HCC says this is necessary for road safety. Traffic lights will be turned off for the duration of the roadworks." The driver continued, "That I've heard nothing from HCC about this, despite living on London Road, is appalling, I think. They really need to get better at telling people these things are going on, as now we're facing 4 weeks of delays and confusion on what is already quite a small, busy roundabout." HCC Cabinet Member for Highways, Phil Bibby, said, "We're carrying out these works during the school holidays when traffic is lighter to minimise disruption. I hope people will bear with us while we carry out these important works. While they will cause some delays for traffic using the roundabout, the end result will be more reliable and better managed traffic lights, and that will improve journeys throughout this important junction." He added that all the roadworks were advertised on boards at the roundabout and on social media in the weeks leading up to the July 23rd when the work began.
Students pilot murder mystery scavenger hunt. A St Albans school has launched a mystery murder app to help pupils explore the dark side of the city centre. Pupils at Marlborough Science Academy in Watling Street were invited to take part in The Dark History of St Albans, a game by downloading the app onto a smartphone. The game is part murder mystery. The player has to solve the murder of Rupert Pinkerton Smith, the third, whose body was found next to a bloody candlestick in St Albans Library, and part educational tour of the city players as they follow a 2-mile trail around the city, and the game should take around 2 hours to complete. The game was designed and created by John Rutherford, the school's associate leader in charge of IT. John and Head of Business Studies Nikki Gold took 6 form pupils out to complete the game earlier this month. Nikki said, "We had a 6 form careers week and the students were off timetable for a whole week, so we took them into St Albans for a day and tried it out. We got about 25 17-year-olds in front of St Albans Museum. They load up the map and the questions and they navigate to a central point of historical interest. And as soon as they get there, up pops a question about where they are. They have to do a scavenger hunt and find the answers. This, then, is like Cluedo. It eliminates an object. There are about 12 or 13 different places of interest, and you end up with the murderer. Prizes were handed out to the pupils who guessed the murderer and got all the answers correct, to pupils who came back in the quickest time with the correct answers, and to all the pupils who completed the game. The next day, pupils were also given prizes for how many facts from the game they could remember." Nikki said, "It really is very cleverly done through Google Maps. The question doesn't appear until you get to the point of interest. The pupils really enjoy going round and finding out the historical facts. They were learning all the different things around St Albans and the gruesome stuff. It's a scavenger hunt, treasure hunt, a murdering mystery. So 3 things all combined into one activity. The pupils absolutely loved it."
Remembering the original Harry Smith. Mystery surrounded a photo we recently published showing a summer outing by the staff and family of a shop located in Verulam Road, taken in 1947. Although we knew the premises later became Harry Smith's Bar and Bistro, we had no idea of its earlier incarnation, and neither did former St Albans Mayor Sali Geygusus, who actually owned the bar at one point in time. So imagine our surprise to learn the shop was actually called Harry Smith's. It was an electrical and car parts business that occupied several of the buildings in the road. Reader Keith Dumbleton revealed, "I can name 4 of the people in the photo you published. The young lady crouching third from left is my mother, Patricia Nylon, later Patricia Dumbleton. She still lives in St Albans, New Greens, and has just celebrated her 90th birthday. Directly behind her are her mother, Hilda Nylon, and to the right, her father, Eric Nylon. Eric worked at Harry Smith's as a delivery driver, and they lived in Berlin Drive. Mum tells me that the young lad next to her is Ray Ferris, who worked at the shop and lived in Marshall's Drive. What a fantastic result! Thanks to Keith for filling in the gaps on this piece of St Albans history, and also supplying the photo we've run this week.
This article's about the new visitor centre in St Albans, in St Albans Park. St Albans Mayor Rosemary Farmer cut the ribbon outside the new Highfield Park Visitor Centre on July 22nd. The new hub was designed because there was no reception or welcome area for the park's increasing number of visitors, but it will also serve as a venue for activities. Building work on the new structure started in September last year. Chair of the Highfield Park Trust, Tim Abbott, said, "It will allow us to do much more, and we are now really looking forward to making it work as we originally planned. Feedback from everybody has been incredible. The building has been very thoughtfully designed, and I think it shows." The new Highfield Park Visitor Centre can be accessed from the Hill End Lane and Frobisher Road Junction.
Wake-up call for City ahead of new season. St Albans City's preparations for the new Vanarama National League season took a jolt after their shock 3-1 defeat to Hertford Town. The Hearts Charity Cup loss on Monday saw City's defensive frailties from last season raise its ugly head once again. And Shell Shock's manager, Ian Allinson, felt it had undone a lot of the good work over the pre-season. He said, "I was really pleased with it until tonight. We've gone to Hendon, Biggleswade and Wingate and Finchley and picked up results. We had to dig deep and defend really hard against them, especially Biggleswade, and that's what's disappointing about this. We've had a hard pre-season and I felt there were a lot of positives from them, even the defeats. I said before the game that I felt we had a group of lads who were going to work extremely hard, but for the first 45 minutes we were awful defensively and we got our backside smacked. That wasn't good enough and we have to improve defensively before Saturday's game." That match sees Hungerford Town visit Clarence Park in the first of this season's league fixtures, and Allinson admits that he may have to rethink his team selection after what was looking like an easy decision before Monday's defeat. He said, "I've now got second thoughts. I've got to take in mind the Wingate game and the Hertford game and make a decision from there. There are a lot of difficult decisions to make this week, but we have to improve defensively, and it was a bit of a jolt. When we went forward, we played some lovely stuff and got in some good areas, but we just couldn't defend. I've got to have a long, hard think before Saturday about which defenders we play. I know we can do it, as we did it at Wingate and Finchley the other night. I was really positive coming off that pitch with how we had defended. It's not a poor thing to happen just before the start of the season. Hopefully it makes us realise we aren't as good as we think we are and we have to go and work extremely hard to get a result. Kick-off on Saturday is at 3 p.m.
Following the success of the World Cup, here's a local article about football. Danny Plum, the Harpenden Town manager, believes Harpenden Town has become the victims of their own success after enduring a difficult summer. They astounded some and delighted others, as their first season in the Spartan South Midlands League Premier Division ended with them coming third and claiming the Dudley Latham Memorial League Cup. But that has put them on the radar of clubs higher up the non-league pyramid and saw players like Connor Sampson, Sam Jenkins, David Keenlyside and top scorer James Ewington make the step up to the higher levels. "It's the poison chalice of coming third," the Harpenden manager said ruefully. "Coming 2 points of getting promoted has killed us. It's certainly not helped us. We've come to everyone's attention, and the players have come to everyone's attention too. Looking back, it's almost the worst situation we could have found ourselves." But despite the outgoings, he's delighted with those players who have chosen to stay with the club, as well as those who have made the move to Rothamsted Park. He said, "We're still OK. We'll be fine. Teams have come in and taken some of our players, but we've recruited well and we've got some new players still to come in. Training has been fine and we've got some really good development players. From where it was 4 years ago, the club is on a fantastic footing. The committee has been brilliant and in my head it has always been about the 5-year plan and this is the 5th year of that. The whole aim was to be a consolidated Premier League side and I've said before, a proper non-league side. That's my aim for the end of the season. It's going to be difficult, but we'll be competitive and organised and we'll be OK. And we've got lots of players like James Yates, Matt Sutton and Harry Hunt still to come back. Harpenden host Leyton Town on Saturday in their first Spartan South Midlands League Premier Division game of the season with a trip to neighbours Coney Heath on Tuesday.
Now an article about local cricket. Playoff hopes dashed and relegation fears grow as Radlett and Harpenden lose. Radlett's hope of making the playoffs took another blow as they lost to Potters Bar by 130 runs. The Cobden Hill-based cricket club are now sixth, 26 points behind Wellingarden City, with just 5 games to go. On the other hand, this third successive victory for Potters Bar catapulted them to third in the division, level on points with North Mimms in second, and only 3 behind the league's Totteridge Millhillions. Yet another dry and dusty service at the walk greeted the teams, and Steve Gale, deputising for skipper James Scott, had no hesitation in batting first after winning the toss. And they made a decent start, putting on 50 inside 13 overs, but it was clear that taking pace off the ball and letting the pitch work its wonders was the way forward. Enter Mohammed Adil Zarif, who took 3 wickets on his way to 3 for 64, claiming the wickets of Harrison Palmer, Thielen Walalawita and Zawar Hussain. Anthony Hill also ended up with 3 wickets, but Gale and Kamran Yunus made life difficult for Radlett and helped Bar post 263 for 8. It was an imposing total, but the seam bowling of Jigar Mehta made sure Radlett wouldn't get close. He took the opening 3 wickets of Chris Arul, Fraser Crawford and Kabir Tour to leave Radlett on 22 for 3 and would eventually finish with 4 for 27. He was ably assisted by Paul McGee, 2 for 18, and Luke Chapman, 2 for 32, while Walalawita and Teddy Duke took 1 each. Radlett did battle away in the middle order, with Archit Goenka hitting 30 and both Joe Cook and Zarif getting 22. However, they were all out for 133 after 42 overs. Harpenden continue to battle against relegation, and their latest game against high-flying Totteridge Millhillions ended in a 5-wicket defeat. They batted first and finished all out for 188. Openers Greg Cooper and Nick Lamb both scored 34, as did number 4 James Latham, but they suffered in the middle order, and only a late flurry from Andrew Neal, 27, and Gus Laws-Mather, 21, brought the score up. Arthur Garrett managed 3 for 66 in reply, but they didn't come close to nabbing the victory, and Totteridge wrapped things up in the 47th over.
Thank you.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Harts Advertiser. Have you heard the cuckoo clock? In April, come he will. In May, he sings all day. In June, he changes his tune. In July, away he will fly. And in August, go he must. This old rhyme sets a natural calendar for spring and summer based on the cuckoo's activities. But I wonder how many of us have seen or even heard a cuckoo this year. I haven't, at least not locally in the St Albans area. I have enjoyed them in the oases of RSPB nature reserves in Kent, Suffolk and Somerset, but not on my doorstep. And yet they used to call in my garden, a herald of spring and a sound of summer. The sad truth is that cuckoos are in decline, and over the last 20 years the number of birds visiting our shores has decreased by over half. This iconic bird, famous for its simple song and infamous for its cuckold ways, is in danger of vanishing from our cultural experience. No other bird is perhaps as embedded in our cultural conscience as the cuckoo that has for centuries kept time and marked the spring and summer seasons. From Aristotle through Chaucer, Shakespeare, Wordsworth and beyond, the cuckoo has been given mention and lent its name to many colloquialisms, such as cuckoo's shoe for bluebells, cuckoo's leader for the wryneck, now extinct as a British breeding bird, and cuckoo's spit, the frothy blobs of foam found on plants in the springtime. None of these, bluebells, wrynecks or cuckoo spit, have anything to do with the cuckoo other than timing. They all coincide with the cuckoo's arrival, and of course the arrival of the much looked forward to springtime. But our cultural cuckoo clock is fast becoming merely a cultural memory, a redundant reference akin to Beyoncé singing about pagers, or the hip-hop duo Outkast telling us to shake it like a Polaroid picture. Craig David sings, "You left all your money on the TV," but I can't help feeling that, just like our modern ultra-thin TVs are no longer the place we can reliably put things on, so the cuckoo has ceased to be a substantial part of our natural furniture. Spring has come and gone, and by and large we did not see the cuckoo come, sing all day, or change his tune. This has led the BTO, the British Trust for Ornithology, to set up the Cuckoo Project to investigate why cuckoo numbers have declined, and specifically to ask the question, what happens to cuckoos when, come July, away they fly to Africa? Now, thanks to developments in technology, cuckoos are being satellite tracked on their journeys across Europe and down into the impenetrable swamp forests of the Congo Basin of Central Africa, where they will overwinter. Already the data has revealed that cuckoos must decide on one of two routes, a western route via Spain and Morocco, or an eastern route via the boot of Italy. Most birds, it seems, have a preferred route, while a few alternate routes year to year. The western route to date, however, has shown a lower survival rate. One cuckoo, nicknamed Chris after the TV presenter Chris Packham, successfully made 7 trips across the Sahara before meeting his end. The tracking project is still live on the BTO website, and individual cuckoos' progress, each with their own nickname, can be viewed on a day-to-day basis. True to the rhyme, this year, most of the adult parent cuckoos are leaving or have already left and are now headed south through France. As I write this article, Cameron the cuckoo, having left the New Forest on the 7th of June, arrived in northern France on the 12th of June. Even keener to get going was Raymond the cuckoo, who has already reached northern Spain and has obviously decided to take the western route. Larry, on the other hand, is in the Balkans, clearly preferring the eastern route. Not so eager to leave is cuckoo Carlton II, who remains at home in the coastal marshes of Suffolk. It is a fascinating project, and viewing the live maps of the bird's progress south, one cannot but help feel concerned for the cuckoo's safety and well-being. Hopefully each bird will return successfully next spring, but with each mile they provide valuable data. Much is still to be learnt about our cuckoos, but the research is beginning to fill in the picture as far as the risks facing cuckoos are concerned. Hopefully, with more than just the summer snapshot we have had of cuckoos in the past, we will now be better placed to conserve their numbers. Maybe, a little like the Polaroid camera, cuckoos will after all enjoy a comeback in Britain, and their simple summer soundtrack will be current again.
This is Peter Burley bringing you a preview of events from mid-August to mid-September. By mid-September, we're in autumn. It'll be Christmas soon. That's something to look forward to. Anyway, for the time being, we do have a wonderful summer. And I'm making a recording, thank goodness, on one of the few days when the heat wave has relented, which makes the studio, I suspect, far more bearable. Anyway, on to the events themselves. And firstly to say that this is a shorter preview than usual because we've hit the time of the year when people are either closed down for the summer or preparing their programmes or still rehearsing. We'll start off with two organ recitals at the Cathedral. There's the Bank Holiday Monday organ recital, and that's on Monday the 27th of August at 1 p.m, and that's being given by Andrew Lucas. The form there is that they're free, but there's a retiring collection. And then we have on Sunday the 9th of September an organ recital, and I don't know if it's a midday or a 5 o'clock one, but there's an organ recital by Tom Winnipenny, who is the assistant master of the music at the Cathedral. Now, staying with organs, we move across to the St Albans Organ Theatre, and we have two events close together. Keith Beckingham is giving a concert on Saturday the 8th of September at 7:30 p.m, and he has been entertaining audiences in the UK and around the world for over 50 years. Then the very next day, we have one of the musical Sunday afternoons, and this is going to be from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Tickets to that are £7 for adults, £3 for children, and there's a concession if more than 10 of you get together to go at the same time, or a £6 concession if you're an OAP. The arena is shut down for the summer, but opens up for its first event on the 12th of September, and again Thursday the 13th of September. And there's a stand-up show by Dylan Moran. It's at 8 p.m. on both nights, and all tickets both nights are £25. And then we have something which will be very good news for some of you, I suspect. I haven't seen this before. There is a gin festival at the arena on Friday the 14th of September through to Saturday the 15th. And tickets for it are £13.50. And it's sponsored by Schweppes, so you know, get some tonic water. There's going to be a fantastic range of gins and live music, street food, and obviously you can buy the gin there as well. Then moving north, we've actually only got one single event at Harpenden Public Halls, and that is on Sunday the 9th of September at 7:30 p.m, and it's Chuck Prophet with Jesse Malin. Now, I'm assuming they're musicians, but I'm afraid all I've got is just the name of the performer and the time and the date. Now, for a bit of drama, we have A Midsummer Night's Dream being performed at the Inn on the Park in Verulamium Park. And this is fairly obviously an open-air performance, and it's going to be performed in Elizabethan costume. The performance is preceded by an inclusive director's talk and an interactive workshop, and you'll be allowed to try on costumes, do some sword fighting, and have fun with the actors. The show is suitable for all the family, it says. And that's one night only, Thursday the 16th of August at 7 in the evening. Tickets are £15 or £13, and there will be free parking after 6 p.m. in Verulamium car park, so you won't get stung for a hefty parking fee if you go there. Now, we've got two plays on at the Abbey Theatre. From Friday the 7th to Saturday the 8th of September, both performances at 7:30 p.m. and both performances in the Studio Theatre, we have Buckets by Adam Barnard. And tickets for this are £9 or £6. Now, the preview says, the all-female cast, between the ages of 18 and 21, present a play comprising of 33 interconnected scenes which tell stories of time and how a lack of it affects our emotions and relationships. They performed there before and been well received. Sorry, I should have said the Buckets is the title of the play, and the theatre company is Theatre of Minds. Proceeds go to a local youth mental health charity. Second play is Butterflies Are Free by Leonard Gersher, and that's running from Friday the 14th, Saturday the 15th at 8 p.m, Sunday the 16th at 2:30 p.m. only, and then Tuesday the 18th to Saturday the 22nd, 8 p.m. all performances. It's on the main stage, performed by the Company of Ten. Tickets are £12 or £11. Now, I suspect there'll be an audio-described performance, but the information I've got hasn't provided which date that's on. Now, young Don Baker, who has been blind since birth, moves to Manhattan to pursue his dream of becoming a songwriter. When his overprotective mother comes to visit, she meets his extrovert actress neighbour, Jill. Mother's controlling instincts go into overdrive with hilarious results. His heartwarming comedy follows Don and Jill as they grow closer and try to justify their places in the world. The New York Times called it a charming play, humorous and quietly moving. Now, something I should have put with the music was a quite different event on at the Sandpit Theatre, again, just one. It's on Sunday the 9th of September at 4pm. All tickets are £10, and I'm going to try and get my tongue around this. Guru Charana Smaranam. It's a showcase of Indian classical dance and music by the students of Kalemanami SMT. Well, I'm not going to persevere, but it's a tribute to some very well-known Indian musicians, performed obviously by Indian musicians, and that is on the 9th of September. Now, we've got an event which I really haven't quite worked out what it is, but I will preview it. It's called St Albans Comic Con, that's C-O-M-I-C, comic, hyphen, con, C-O-N. It's on Sunday the 2nd of September. It's at Westminster Lodge. It opens at 10 a.m. Adults or teenagers at 8pm, children £4, carers £8, and there are lots more activities and attractions on the day. And I think it's based around comics, but with people who've appeared in television shows or films taken with the script taken from comics. As I say, there's a lot more events, street food and things like that going on at the same time around it. There's a very strong presence from Game of Thrones people. Staying with Westminster Lodge, we have a new event this year, which is a summer fair celebrating vegan food. As I say, it takes place at the Westminster Lodge Leisure Centre, and it will feature more than 60 stalls, cooking classes and things, all on the vegan food theme. It's going to be on August the 27th. Doors open at 10 a.m. and it closes at 4 p.m. Entrance is £1 on the door, although elsewhere I've seen it advertised as being £3. And it's organised by a Lithuanian who lives in Luton. As a little bit of interesting background. Now, the last event I've got for you is, again, a very different nature indeed, and it's one of a series that's happening this year of Gorhambury House Talks, and it's been given by the Countess of Verulam on the theme of my life and art at Gorhambury. And she actually lived there from 1977 to 2012, is a celebrated artist, and talking about her art and her experience of actually living in the stately, in our local stately home. That's going to be on Wednesday the 12th of September. It starts at 10:30, it'll finish at noon. Tickets are all £15, and if you want to get a ticket, you need to contact Heidi Treadwell on St Albans 855-000. And the last thing I'll mention is that we have two bites of the historic Open Day cherry this year. They seem to be doing it over two weekends. So these are days when a lot of buildings which are not normally open will be. And the first weekend is the 8th to the 9th of September. And the second weekend is the 14th to the 15th of September. I will just mention one place locally which brought to my attention an extraordinary thing. There is a 100-scale model of the Myrna Dam, as in the Dam Busters Raid, at the Building Research Establishment. And it's one of their featured attractions for the Heritage Open Day when they open on the 8th of September. And it has an amazing history. It actually was used for the training of a Dam Buster Squadron. And they actually blew it up during the war. And then it was rebuilt in 1960 as a tribute to the whole episode. And it's still there today. And it's still one of Hertfordshire's most, I think, unusual attractions. So there's a thought to conjure with. And I shall be back with you for events from September to October in a month's time.
So it was a pleasure to welcome Stephen De Silva back to the studio, who's given us many memorable accounts of things to do with the cathedral. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
The cathedral is moving forward in the sense that the Visitor Centre, which is after the new museum and gallery, the next exciting development. What's the schedule on that? I've seen that the scaffolding is still up.
We just laid the concrete floor on the new Visitor Centre. That's very exciting. The work inside the chapter house from 1980, that's been completed substantially. So now it's building the welcome centre to fit between the chapter house and the cathedral itself. The timetable is almost exactly a year away. We're talking in the last week of June in 2018, and on the 22nd of June 2019, which is St. Albans Day, which falls very nicely on a Saturday, we shall open the new Welcome Centre. So we're really excited. A year's countdown now to the great event.
I think it must be something to do with the faith that underlies the cathedral that you're prepared to put a date.
Well, we think the building will be finished maybe a couple of months before then. That's the plan. That's what the builders tell us anyway. So, yes, we have faith that we're going forward with this. I mean, the whole thing has been that kind of faith project. I mean, look back 10 years and just, I don't know, any of us would have believed this was really happening.
Just talk me through the route. You would come in from Sumter Yard, or can you come in anywhere to the visitor centre from any side?
You can enter the cathedral from the West End, you know, the grand entrance facing St. Albans School. But the truth is, and we've known this for 20 years now, that the vast majority of visitors come through Sumter Yard. They'll either come down Waxhouse Gate or they'll come from Hollywell Hill. And that's really why the Welcome Centre is being built there, because that's where we need to greet the majority of our visitors. So you'll walk down Sumter Yard in a beautifully landscaped Sumter Yard. We're just about to approve, we hope, the plans for the landscaping there. And be welcomed into this new visitor centre with all singing, all dancing facilities.
And it will be effectively tucked between the back of the chapter house and the south come east end of the cathedral.
Yes, the southeast wall of the cathedral. Yes, that's right. So it's going to fill in basically a square that exists there. Originally, I was thinking, well, we're not going to gain that much space. But I stood yesterday looking at the new floor that's been laid, and it's actually a really big space. It's going to be very exciting. So you'd be able to walk in that door, the entrance, and imagine that ahead of you there is a desk to greet you with volunteers and staff to say hello. There'll be an audiovisual screen telling you what's on today in the cathedral. There'll be a great timeline to tell you the story of the cathedral and entice, we hope, you in. There'll be brand new loos for visitors, and that's really important because we've had problems and comments about our loos in the past, and I think they've all been very fair comments. But also, if you can imagine coming in that doorway, you'll be able to turn left towards the refectory, the abbot's kitchen, because the floor in there has been raised, so it'll all be on one level. It'll be a fantastic open space for events, but also to greet our visitors, and also make things so much easier for somebody who might be with a pushchair or a wheelchair or using some other mobility aid. There also is going to be a lift in the chapter house. So young people who want to get up to the classrooms or adults who want to get up to the classrooms on the second and third floor can use the lift. That's never been possible till now.
And if you turn right on going in, you will go into where the books are currently?
Well, where the current bookshop is, that all will come into the new Welcome Centre. So there will be a shop area to the right of the entrance. As you come into the Welcome Centre, there'll be a shop area and an information desk and that kind of thing there. You'll be led round through the timeline into the cathedral. We're going to have some good audiovisual displays. I've had the great pleasure of being the internal editor for the text on the timeline. So that's been a real challenge. And then you'll enter into the cathedral through the doors that were always there. And ahead of you will be the great rose window and more information and more discovery.
Pretty interesting time for St. Albans because the museum and gallery having to open this summer, and now this is next summer. I mean,
St. Albans has gone through a step change, let's be honest. In these 2 years, it's really upped the game. Mm. And quite rightly so. You know, we are, as you and I know, we're one of England's best kept secrets, St. Albans. Not enough people understand how important and lovely a town and city it is. This is really going to change things. I've got some American friends coming, and I'm really looking forward to showing them the old Georgian Town Hall because it's just beautiful. I mean, the real star of that renovation is the building. It's just fantastic.
Mm. Of course, you talk about secrets. When you start to dig, you find other secrets.
Absolutely, yeah. Just, you know, lay a tennis court and, well, there you go. Yes, of course, we found all kinds of things. And we knew we were going to find burials because we understood what we were doing. In fact, our original intention was not to disturb any of the burials, but to build the Welcome Centre as a kind of what's called a raft. So it would sit on the ground. But unfortunately, the burials were so close to the surface, we hadn't realised how close to the surface they were.
Those would have been, what, recent, from 19th century ones?
Yeah, those were sort of 1750 to 1850. Mm-hmm. They were only a couple of feet below the surface, so there was no way that we could have sunk foundations without disturbing them. So then, of course, you have to do the quite correct and proper thing. which is to carefully lift them, archaeologically look at them all carefully, study them, because you do learn something about your predecessors in this place. And then they will be reverently reburied in the North Churchyard later on.
And how far did you have to dig down? Were you encouraged to dig down because you kept finding more and more?
Well, the cathedral archaeologists wanted us to look as far as possible because, you know, there is a Roman burial ground under the cathedral, which is what we always say is important to understand, that that is fixes the site of St. Albans' burial very clearly, I think. And we wanted to see how far that Roman burial ground extended. I haven't seen the final report. I don't believe they quite got down to that layer, but they certainly got down to a medieval layer beyond the 19th and 18th century burials that we knew were there.
Just out of interest, when did it cease to be a burial ground? You talked about 1750 to...
About 1850, 1860, thereabouts. It was clearly full by that time. And so post-1860, the burials tend to be on the north side of the cathedral. That's why most of the, if you look at those gravestones on the north, they tend to be late 1800s. The burials are there. Of course, that graveyard itself is now closed. And so it's only a burial for ashes, except for very significant people like bishops. So yes, the actual area we knew had not been used as a cemetery. But what we didn't really understand was what was maybe beneath the 18th and 19th century burials. And that's been some of the more exciting stuff that we've discovered. We've always had this question about where was Abbot John of Wheatamstead, who was abbot in one of the abbots of the 1400s. We knew he'd built a chapel for himself, but the chapel area that the records say were his, we've never really found it. We never found evidence of a proper chapel there. But there was clearly something very large being uncovered when the archaeologists were doing their work, a much more substantial chapel or room. And it was in the floor of this rather more substantial chapel or room that the burial of Abbot John was uncovered. He was abbot twice, unusually. He was abbot, retired. His successor was abbot for about 10 years and then died. And Abbot John was re-elected in old age to be abbot. We wonder, we don't know, this speculation, did he build himself a second, slightly grander chapel during his second abbacy? And perhaps his original one that we've always said was Abbot John's chantry chapel got used for something else.
Did you find a coffin or was the...
No, the burial was there, so the bones were there. The other substantial thing were these three papal medallions that we can talk about as well. But no, there was no coffin as such. The archaeologists will be able to tell us how that burial had been prepared. I doubt very much that it would have been coffined in the 1400s. He probably would have been shrouded and laid within a tomb, but any material is gone. There was substantially just the bones. There may be other traces, and we're looking forward to reading that report. Were there traces of anything else that was there?
And were there other bones of other people, or was that those? Was it his?
That was the most significant one. Yeah. He was in his own personal chamber. I actually had a chance to see that before it was lifted, and it was amazing. So he was in his own lined chamber. So quite clearly, this was a significant person. And as soon as Professor Clark, who's our advisor, he's professor of history at Exeter University, who's the expert on John of Wheatamstead, as soon as Professor Clark saw the three papal seals, he was pretty clear who had been buried there.
That
was the real kind of clue. It was roughly in line with where we thought Abbot John might have had a chantry, but these three papal seals and the study of the bones, the age of the person, this was an older man, quite significantly older for those days, and this was clearly Abbot John of Wheatamstead.
You just called him Abbot John of Wheatamstead, and that's...
It is tricky, isn't it? He comes from Wheatamstead, so he's often called John of Wheatamstead in the way that people were often surnamed by the place they came from. So he's not the Abbot of Wheatamstead, he's Abbot John of Wheatamstead.
Because his family lived in...
family lived in Wheatamstead. In fact, his parents and his siblings are buried at St. Helen's Church in Wheatamstead, and there's a very firm and clear connection there. He entered the abbey as a boy. He would have been entered by his parents, brought there to study as a monk, as a young man, a very talented young man in many ways, rose swiftly, and as I say, has become perhaps one of the most famous of our abbots.
So what's the position of an abbot? It's the abbot is in charge of the monastery.
The abbot is in charge of the whole monastery. So an abbey, and you have to remember St. Albans was England's first abbey. Pope Adrian IV had many centuries earlier given us the title of England's premier abbey. And so the abbot of St. Albans was an exceedingly important person, not just locally, because he governed the abbey and then, in fact, governed St. Albans, but abbots of St. Albans were national figures. They were advisors to the kings. I mean, his really good friends were Henry V, Henry V's brother, Humphrey, who's actually buried at St. Albans. John will have known all of them. He'll have known Edward IV. He'll have known all of their wives, the queens. He moved in important circles.
So he would have been a politician as well as a...
Absolutely. You have to remember, for example, you know, when Parliament in those days met, the abbots of England were part of Parliament. And in fact, there are stories about Abbot John and the Abbot of Westminster not quite having a tussle about who sat in first rank amongst the abbots, because the Abbot of Westminster always believed he was the first abbot of England, and the Abbot of St. Albans always believed he was the first abbot of England, and they often had a little disagreement.
He was such an important person. Is this why he went to Rome? And
all abbots usually went to the Pope to be confirmed in their abbacy. That was quite a common thing. So we know that, you know, for example, Thomas de la Mare in the 1300s went off to Avignon, that's where the papacy was at that point, to be confirmed in his abbacy. So that's what he did towards the beginning of his reign as abbot, which is about 1420. He's elected then. And he goes off to Rome to be confirmed. He actually goes to one of the church councils, the Council of Siena, and he's taken ill. And the Pope sends his personal physician to care for, this is Pope Martin, sends his personal physician to care for Abbot John, and John recovers. And we don't really know the whole details. I mean, someone suggests that he, you know, he's then going to use the situation to get the most he can out of his visit. You know, I was near death, and oh, Father, could you grant us these special privileges, you know, as a sign of your favour and God's favour to me? And he does. He gets particular privileges for the abbey in terms of how it can manage its income, how it can manage some of its religious feasts. So it's quite an important thing. So
what's the significance of these privileges? Does that mean he can change the practice, or is he going against the law?
In effect, it's a dispensation from usual practice. So there would have been common practice about how rents were managed or income was managed, or how perhaps religious services were governed. Papal bulls, and these were called bulls, these documents, these promises from the Pope, in effect, gave you freedom from the rules, freedom from the standard conditions that would exist. And so St. Albans was able to use its income more freely than perhaps the standard abbey might. All abbeys received income in different ways. St. Albans had more freedom to be creative about how it used its funding.
We don't really know what difference that made, what sort of things they would have done with the money that they couldn't do before.
Probably they did simple things like have more control over investing it locally. So using it for building locally, or perhaps for relief of the poor in a particular way. We don't have those details, but the monks always remembered Abbot John and honoured him for these three papal bulls. In fact, when they wrote his obituary, they said that he had a threefold character. And I think that's not unusual. They were talking about, they were alluding to these three special promises that he'd extracted from the Pope. These were seen as signs of great honour for somebody who'd been powerful enough to have achieved those things.
So he comes back with these three documents.
He does, these three documents.
And the bull is the seal, is that right?
So what we found in the grave were seals, the kind of seal that would be affixed to the bottom of the document. We're not sure that these are the three original seals. It seems unlikely, but we're not sure that he would have been buried with the originals. He may have had these made as symbols, symbolic copies of the seals. He may have worn these in his lifetime, we don't know, but he clearly wanted to be buried with them as a sign of his great privileges.
Not a seal in the sense that you see the wax and the king or queen stamps their ring on it. It's not that.
Imagine a disc of wax or metallized wax, maybe 3 centimeters or so across. It's like a coin. Imagine a large looking coin. That's what was found. They were so encrusted, it was difficult to read them. They're being cleaned now, and we can see very clearly that they're Pope Martin V, which is the relevant pope.
And so there's text on there.
Only the pope's name and his titles. In fact, he's called the Pastor Pastorum, the Shepherd of the Shepherds. That's one of the titles that the popes used for themselves. These three seals will be, we hope, on display in the new visitor centre and the new exhibition centre next year. We're also hoping, if it's possible, because a substantial amount of the abbot's skull was intact, we're looking at the possibility of a facial reconstruction, a digital facial reconstruction, which would be very exciting to look on the face of the man who did these things. It would be a wonderful thing.
Are his remains going to be put somewhere within the
Yes, we'll have to think carefully. I mean, there are all kinds of places we could bury them. if you stand in front of the high altar of the cathedral and look up, there's this glorious roof with lots of gold leaf on it, eagles and lambs. This is Abbot John of Wheatamstead's design. The eagle and the lamb were his personal symbols. Eagle, St. John the Evangelist, lamb, St. John the Baptist. He created that ceiling. He had it beautifully painted to honour his patron saints. Many have said it would be very appropriate to bury him under this great ceiling to recall that. Others have suggested, you know, he was a very good friend of Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. Should his remains be placed within Humphrey's crypt? The only person with a crypt in the building is this royal duke. Because they were good colleagues and friends, might that be a suitable resting place for his bones? They will be reburied with some honour, I think, in the future.
And not in a way that we'll see the bones. These will all be...
No, they will be seen. Yes, I mean, and that will be true for all of the burials. I mean, all the burials in the excavation will be treated with that kind of honour and respect, having studied them and learnt something about particularly the diseases and things that affected people. They'll be reverently reburied and appropriately reburied. That's the way the church treats human remains.
What do you think Abbot John would think about all of this?
I think he'd be ever so pleased we were remembering him. He was somebody who was very proud of his achievements. Somebody once asked Professor Clark, who has, as I say, studied him, would we have liked Abbot John if we'd met him? And Professor Clark is a bit dubious about that, because Abbot John was rather full of himself. I think that would be the way we might describe it today. But I think he would be incredibly pleased to be honoured in that way and to be remembered in that way. You know, I sometimes say when I show people that painted ceiling, you know, Abbot John painted this so he could be remembered. And look, I've just remembered him. He must be really, really pleased about that.
By definition, we talked about him as a very powerful religious leader, and religious leaders were very powerful politically. He was very close to the king and the other members of the royal family at various times. I mean, Henry V is one to have known, isn't it? Yeah,
absolutely.
you suggested he was sort of full of himself. What do we know about him? I mean, who wrote about him? Does he appear in all sorts of history books?
Well, of course, we have a really good record of the abbots in St. Albans, and that's one of the great things about St. Albans Abbey, that we have, although we don't personally possess the documents, there's an incredibly good chronicle of all that the abbots did. So, of course, he's praised and honoured in the chronicles. But there was also a kind of biography written about him after his death. And again, I'm relying on Professor Clark here because I haven't read the original document. But Professor Clark says it's fairly clear that John probably had a significant hand in writing this biography of himself. It's purported to be written by another monk. Professor Clark suggests Abbot John might have written it himself and then, you know, kind of put a ghostwriter's name on top of it. Just to, you know, you can't really write about yourself and praise yourself that much. So somebody else has to praise you. So he puts someone else's name, perhaps, to the biography.
Yeah. Fascinating. It's going to be very exciting to get into the visiting centre and start.
It really will be. I think it'll just be a step change for all of our visitors. I think we really want to tell the story of St. Albans. We want to promote the whole principle, and I've talked about it before with you here, that Alban is Britain's first saint. You know, this is the oldest place of Christian worship. We've got so many exciting stories to tell. We don't want to turn it into a museum. This is a living church, not a museum. But there will be signs around the building to help you interpret what you're seeing. And of course, later on in 2019, the great wall paintings, the four huge figures of the wall paintings, will be illuminated in their original colours. That will be a projection. We just tested the projectors last week, and I wasn't there. Unfortunately, I couldn't be there, but everyone came away from the test just so excited at the possibilities of illuminating these paintings in their original colours, so that people get a sense of just how glorious the medieval church was, and why we're told pilgrims entered St. Albans Abbey and dropped to their knees because they thought they were in heaven. The beauty of the building. It'd be nice to just echo some of that.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hello, and a warm welcome to Journey, the Thought for the Week from Torch Trust. Today's thought is by Lynn Ball, a talented writer and friend of Torch Trust. I'm Jill Ferriby, and I'm going to share Lynn's thoughts with you. A few months ago, my husband and I spent 5 days on the Isle of Wight organising a residential care home place for a dear relative who's 97. Our B&B was in Shanklin, a matter of minutes from a beautiful sea view. One evening we sat there eating, what else, fish and chips on a bench, one of many lining that cliff-top walk. All the benches are dedicated to departed loved ones. What would you like written on the plaque of a bench dedicated to you, and where would it be? Much as I love Shanklin, my bench would be in Queen's Square in my home city, Bristol. an oasis of calm in a chaotic city, Queen's Square is an open space of lawns and wide paths with mature trees bordered with Georgian townhouses. It's a peaceful transition between the noisy racetrack of the city centre, the historic cobbled streets around the 18th century Theatre Royal, and the colourful harbourside crammed with pavement cafes. But to me, it's more than that. Queen's Square speaks of my early life. From the age of 11, the number 28 bus carried me through Queen's Square to school and back each day. It's a couple of hundred yards from where a late-night encounter turned my life at 18 to start a journey to faith. It's the site of my first workplace, where I met the love of my life, a shy and somewhat scruffy designer. How often we left the office separately at lunchtime to meet clandestinely in that square and loiter under the shade of its rustling trees. As for the dedication on that bench in Queen Square, I'm not sure. I'm still working on that. Maybe something like, Lynn Ball, she longed to make a difference for God. How would your inscription read? Well, that's certainly something to think about, isn't it? You've been listening to Journey, produced by Torch Trust, a Christian organisation for people at any stage of the sight loss journey. Torch runs a free lending library of Christian books and produces magazines in audio, giant print and braille. Find out more on the website at torchtrust.org or just call on 0333 123 1255 or email info@torchtrust.org.